CareerEdge.com.
This is Once for All, where Jude 3 says, I found it necessary to write appealing to you to contend for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. Listen in as the faith held by believers of all times is now delivered to you.
To another edition of Once for All. I'm your host, Pastor Evan Gigline. I'm the pastor of Faith Lutheran Church in Rogue River, Oregon, and we have been continuing this series talking about the book of Revelation, and we'll be doing that also again today. If you always have comments or questions, you can give us a call, 1-844-51-FAITH, 1-844-51-FAITH. We'll take your emails at deliveredonceforall@gmail.com, deliveredonceforall@gmail.com, and do check out some of our past episodes. That's found at onceforallradio.com. My guest for this series on Galatians is Pastor Alex Ling. He's pastor at Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Albany, Oregon. Pastor Ling, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we're going to be picking up with chapter 2 today. Last week, we saw that Paul was going to seem to be great extent to show that he did not come up with this gospel because he got it from other people, but he actually received it directly from Jesus himself. And he goes to length then to say, look, I wasn't in contact with anyone except for maybe these few people. Continuing then with chapter 2, verse says, then after an interval of 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along also. This is maybe a historical fact. Anything of significance here?
Just telling us that this is another visit to Jerusalem and Barnabas and Titus. The significance of Titus will come up later, but again, this is just another visit to Jerusalem. He already visited Jerusalem once. I'll just remind the hearers that for many scholars, they believe that this is the third visit to Jerusalem, whereas I tend to believe it's the second one. The second one told in Revelation, not Revelation, Acts. In the book of Acts, there's four visits to Jerusalem, and I think this is the second one, partly because I think it would be really strange for Paul to mention the third visit without mentioning the second. And then there's other reasons. We'll see as we go on why I think that this might be the second visit to Jerusalem. But Paul's setting up the stage for another. He's encountering the apostles another time, and he's just kind of setting the stage for us.
Right, very good. Well, now verse 2 then says, it was because of a revelation that I went up, and I submitted to them the gospel which I preach among the Gentiles, but I did so in private to those who were of reputation, for fear that I might be running or had run in vain. What's he getting at here?
Well, we're not told. He doesn't tell us what this revelation is. Apparently, there's this divine. The Lord, in some way, is telling Paul and Barnabas to go to Jerusalem. I have a hunch. It's just speculation on my part, but I have a hunch that maybe the revelation he's speaking about might be the prophecy in Acts chapter 11. At the very end of chapter 11. It says, now in these days, prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch, and one of them named Agabus stood up and foretold by the Spirit that there would be a great famine over all the world. So the disciples determined everyone according to his ability to send relief to the brothers living in Judea. They did so by sending Barnabas and Saul. And so this is, of course, the second. Saul and Barnabas are then going to be going to visit Jerusalem. This is the second time Paul is going to go there. And notice they're going because of this vision of Agabus. And so it's quite possible that when he says a revelation, it could very well be that revelation given to them through Agabus. Though, again, I'm just speculating. When he's up there, he wants to meet with these apostles and leaders of the church privately. Those who seemed influential, because he wants to talk a little bit about the gospel. And he says, you know, I wanted to make sure that we were in agreement on these things, lest we, you know, were running in vain. In other words, he wants to make sure that they are in agreement, so that way they're, you know, that they're not, in a sense, competing against each other, giving messages that contradict each other, so that they're, you know, doing the same work for the same kingdom, the kingdom of God. And so we're going to be talking here about the gospel. And as we're going to learn, there's going to be some people there in this meeting who do believe that Gentiles should have to keep the law in order to receive God's blessing and be members of the church. And we're going to see, do the apostles agree with Paul, or do they agree with these Jewish Christians who want to force the law onto Gentiles? And so that's what remains to be seen.
Now, you said it before in a previous broadcast, but because it'll apply here in this context, tell us again, maybe in brief, what these others, the ones who came to the churches of Galatia, were teaching them about the gospel.
Right. Well, you know, again, they would consider themselves baptized Christians. They would say, yes, Jesus is the Messiah and the Son of God. And of course, faith plays a role in salvation and so forth. But they would say, look, you read through the Old Testament, the law is not optional. If you want to be a member of God's people, you have to keep the law given in the Old Testament. You have to obey the commandments. And this, of course, you know, includes things like circumcision. And they would say, look, you know, if you're not going to keep the law, you have to, you're no longer part of the church, and you will not receive God's blessing. If you do keep the law, if you're trying to live according to the law of Moses, well, then you can be a member of the church, and you can receive the blessing of God. And so, really, this becomes for Paul a matter of not only who can be a member of the church and who cannot be a member of the church. This becomes a matter of justification. In other words, does God approve of me and bless me because simply because he loves me and because of what Jesus has done for me? Or is it a matter of God's rewarding me for something I've done because of human effort, human choices, that sort of thing? And so this is all a matter of, do Gentiles need to keep the law of Moses or not?
So that's pretty significant when we come to verse 3, when Paul says, in meeting with all of these others privately, verse 3 says, but not even Titus, who was with me, though he was a Greek, was compelled to be circumcised.
Yeah, in a sense, this is a perfect opportunity to kind of see where everyone's allegiance lies, what everyone truly believes. Because here you have Titus, who followed Paul in some of his journeys. He's a pastor, and he's a convert to Christianity. He's a Greek. He's not Jewish. That means he's not circumcised. So, you know, you bring Titus in, and so it's, the question is, are we going to force Titus to be circumcised or not? And if the apostles kind of, you know, if they force Titus to be circumcised, well, then that means they ultimately believe that the law is absolutely necessary. They agree with Paul's rivals. They're preaching a different gospel. If they don't force Titus to be circumcised, then we see then the apostles agree with Paul. And so, you know, this is kind of, you know, a demonstration of, you know, what do the apostles at Jerusalem really believe? And as we'll see, Titus was not forced to be circumcised. Ultimately, the apostles, they sided with Paul. They agreed with Paul.
You know, one thing that's striking to me about this is we're still dealing with the question of authority. What does the authority say about this issue? Are we to be circumcised? Are we not to be circumcised in keeping the law? And Paul is going to really the question of apostleship. Is he an apostle, and does he fit with all the other apostles? Now, maybe others in Christendom would have a different perspective when they go to authority. They would say, look, he's going to a council, so it's the church that determines these problems. But when we're looking at the actual teachings and works of the apostles, wouldn't that be akin for Christians today simply to read the Word of God and the writings of those prophets and apostles?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we need to realize that the ultimate authority of the church is Jesus. He is the head of the church. And he gave these apostles a purpose, a mission, the authority to preach his message to the church. And if you want to know what the apostles said, what they taught, you read what they wrote, the scriptures. So that's our ultimate authority as Christians. We do not decide what is truth by vote through councils or through committees. Nor do we use human authority. See, here's the thing about the apostles. You don't want to say that the apostles, that this is a matter of human authority. It's ultimately not about the apostles themselves. Paul kind of, makes this clear. He keeps saying those who seemed influential, those who seemed, referring to the apostles, he's kind of downplaying their authority to a certain degree. Obviously, he recognizes they are apostles, like himself. But his point here is this: Jesus is the ultimate authority. Either you preach the word Jesus gave to us or you don't. And so, if the apostles are preaching the word given to them by Jesus, then yeah, you need to heed them and obey them. But that's really what's at the heart of the matter is, what is the gospel of Jesus Christ, the gospel given to us by Jesus Christ? And so it's not even a matter of human authority. It's not a matter of office. This is one of the things that the Roman Catholics get wrong. Roman Catholics say, we're the true church because we still have the same office. Peter had an office, an apostolic office, and that's passed down to every pope. So the pope has the same office as Peter did, and so therefore the pope has authority and he decides what is true. And it's like, no, Jesus is the head of the church. He decides what is the truth and what is the message we preach. He gave that to the original apostles to preach. And so if you want to know what the gospel is, you go to the original words of the apostles. That is where we receive truth, is through the scriptures. And so this is, of course, the classic Reformation debate. Do we believe in scripture alone or not?
Hmm. Now, Paul says, look, not even Titus was compelled to be circumcised, so that validates what Paul is saying. And in verse 4, but it was because of the false brethren secretly brought in, who had sneaked in to spy out our liberty, which we have in Christ Jesus, in order to bring us into bondage. A neat kind of contrast between bondage and liberty. What does this verse mean?
Yeah, he's going to talk more about the idea of liberty and slavery later on. That's going to be kind of a major theme for him, that the gospel gives liberty or freedom, whereas the law ultimately leads to slavery. We'll discuss that, no doubt, later on, when he said has more to say on the issue. But here, his point is here kind of saying, that there were these people who call themselves Christians, who may even have been, kind of leaders in the church, not the apostles themselves, but maybe other pastors or something. These people were there. He kind of describes them as if they kind of slipped in, kind of like spies. And he describes them as kind of spies of the enemy. And when he says he's trying to take away our freedom, he means they were trying to, in a sense, steal the gospel away from us. How? By saying you have to circumcise Titus. And it's rather interesting. He's depicting these other Christians as no good, dirty, rotten spies of the enemy, who are trying to steal the very gospel away from us.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, almost just this notion of wanting to spy out our liberty. In other words, they want to gaze upon the freedom that we have in Christ when they're the ones who are putting themselves into bondage by their own law. And that's maybe kind of commonplace that people. It's not that the Lord has put people in bondage, but people have put themselves in bondage.
And then try to put others into bondage too. The same shackles that I wear, you have to wear as well.
Yeah, interesting. All right, well, let's take a break right there. We're talking with Pastor Alex Lang. He's pastor of Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Albany, Oregon. We're talking about Galatians chapter 2. Glad you're with us on Once for All. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
With SRN News, I'm Keith Peters in Washington. What has President Donald Trump learned in his first year as president? That you have to lead with heart. That's what Mr. Trump told news network anchors during a pre-State of the Union lunch Tuesday. Mr. Trump said you govern with all of the instincts of a business person, but you have to have much more heart and soul into your decisions than you would ever have even thought of before. Key players in the opioid industry and the cities and counties suing them gathered together in a federal courtroom in Ohio to start discussions toward a possible settlement. The federal judge overseeing the consolidated cases wants any future settlement to include steps for solving the crisis, which claims tens of thousands of lives in the U.S. each year. State attorneys general will also be represented at the talks in Cleveland. A rough day on Wall Street as the Dow is down by 363 points. More details at SRNnews.com.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
The March for Life in Washington, D.C. was massive this year. The president and vice president made remarks via live video from the White House Rose Garden. The president hailed marchers, saying, "You come from many backgrounds and many places, but you all come for one beautiful cause, to build a society where life is celebrated and protected and cherished." The president does more than say nice things. He's the most pro-life president in our nation's history. His list of accomplishments is nothing short of amazing, and we do have a list. Visit lifeissues.org and click on the microphone icon for details. This pro-life president needs our prayers, so please commit to daily praying that God will give him wisdom to protect American lives, born and unborn.
Follow us on Twitter at LifeIssuesUSA and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
With me, SRN News Business Brief, I'm Dennis Crowley. Walmart is cutting jobs in its global business, finance, human resources, merchandise, real estate, and technology divisions. The mayor of Bentonville, Arkansas, says there will be fewer than 500 total job losses at Walmart's home office in the city. The Trump administration is preparing to unveil its plans for roads, bridges, and other infrastructure next month. President Trump says he will unveil his plan after next week's State of the Union address. He says his plan could generate as much as $1.7 billion in infrastructure spending. He says he is counting on state and local governments to come up with a significant share of the total. And on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed more than 140 points with business. I'm Dennis Crowley.
Welcome back to Once for All. Today we are going through and continuing our conversation about Galatians today in chapter 2. We're looking at chapter 5 now. If you want to send us an email about any comments or questions you have, you can send us an email deliveredonceforall@gmail.com. deliveredonceforall@gmail.com. So we're now coming to verse 5 then, after these secret brethren have been brought in. It says, "But we did not yield in subjection to them for even an hour, so that the truth of the gospel would remain with you." Fascinating way that he articulates this, that not even for an hour would we put ourselves in subjection to them.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Well, not even for a moment. Not even for a not even in a moment. Paul and Barnabas resisted them. They fought back and said, "No, we're not going to circumcise Titus." And notice the phrase, "the truth of the gospel." That phrase is going to appear a lot in chapter 2. Again, Paul here in this section, he's pointing out that my gospel is true and reliable because it comes from Jesus. And so again and again, he talks about the gospel truth, the truth of the gospel.
You know, it strikes me that I suppose Paul and those with him could have, for the sake of getting along with those who are being divisive and just, okay, you know, we don't think that we have to do this, but, you know, if it's going to bring peace, if it's going to make everybody happy, we'll just go ahead and insist on circumcision so that we can get along with, be more unified. But this verse is very clear that Paul was insistent that we not do that.
Yeah, you know, and it gets even more interesting when you consider the fact, consider the story of Timothy, another pastor. Timothy, it's the story of Timothy is rather different, where Paul, where Timothy agrees to get circumcised so that he could, you know, be a kind of a missionary to the Jews and work alongside the Jews in Paul's missionary journeys. And so Timothy actually does go through with it. He gets circumcised, but Titus does not. So, you know, it's like, you know, is Paul being inconsistent here? What's going on? Well, you know, he says this later on, that circumcision doesn't matter. You know, if you're circumcised, okay. If you're not, okay. It doesn't matter. And so, you know, he is willing at times, you know, for the sake of the ignorant and the weak, you know, to make concessions, to say, you know, hey, circumcision doesn't matter, you know, so let's, you know, hey, Timothy, would you be willing to be circumcised so, you know, we can have kind of an opportunity to talk to Jews? Yeah, I'd be willing to do that, because it doesn't matter. But here, this is very different with Titus. With Titus, these people who should know better are trying to force Titus to be circumcised, saying that circumcision, that your relationship with God and your eternal salvation depends on whether or not you're circumcised. See, the point here is this, is that these opponents are saying, yes, circumcision absolutely matters. Everything depends on it. And so, you know, ultimately, you know, am I saved? Does God love me? All these questions are answered by, you know, well, are you circumcised? And for Paul to circumcise Titus in this situation would be to betray the gospel. It would be to say, yeah, you're right. We can only, ultimately, our relationship with God and our salvation depends on something we do. And that's a concession Paul can never make. If he concedes that, then he's giving up the gospel, which he'll never do.
Paul continues, and those who seem to be influential, what they were makes no difference to me. God shows no partiality. Those, I say, who seemed influential added nothing to me. What does this verse mean?
Well, again, he's you know, Paul's trying to walk kind of on a tightrope here. He wants to confess several truths at the same time. He wants to acknowledge the fact that these apostles are apostles. The same Jesus who gave authority to Paul gave authority to them. They received the same gospel as he did. And ultimately, he's trying to say here in this story, you know, you false teachers claim that the apostles sent you. You know, that you know the apostles sent you, and you're preaching the gospel that Peter and James preach. But I say to you, that's not true. I talk to the apostles, and they agree with me. They preach the same gospel as I do. So on the one hand, Paul's trying to say that. On the other hand, though, he's also kind of saying, you know, look, you know, this is not a matter of human authority. This is a matter of what has Jesus given to us. And so, ultimately, Peter, Paul, James, all these men, they're men. You know, we don't believe what they say because Peter or Paul said it. We believe it because it's what Jesus gave them to preach to us. And so, you know, Paul's kind of, you know, trying to confess several truths at the same time. That's why he keeps saying, you know, they seemed influential, you know, what they are makes no difference to me, that sort of thing. And then he says, you know, these other apostles, yeah, they're other apostles. They didn't add anything to me. They added nothing to me. Again, Paul's making the point that, yes, I did meet with the other apostles. We met on a couple of occasions. Every time I met with the apostles, they didn't teach me, they didn't instruct me, they didn't say, Paul, you don't understand the gospel here, we're going to give you the true gospel. They added nothing to me. I already received the full gospel when Jesus first appeared to me on the Damascus Road. You know, and so that's why he's going through all these stories. He's trying to show, you know, you rivals claim that you received the gospel from the apostles in Jerusalem. Well, they preach the same gospel I do, and I received this gospel from Jesus himself. The apostles and other Christians, they added nothing to me. I received it only from Jesus.
All right, so verse 7 then says, on the contrary, when they saw that I had been entrusted with the gospel to the uncircumcised, just as Peter had been entrusted with the gospel to the circumcised, for he also worked through Peter for his apostolic ministry to the circumcised, worked also through me for mine to the Gentiles. So he's making a parallel to Peter's ministry, who is particularly interested to speak to the Jews, and Paul was entrusted to the gospel to speak to Gentiles, but they're both coming from the same source, are they not?
Exactly. Yeah, and they're preaching the same message. It's just the audience that's different, you know. So some of the original apostles, being Jews themselves, being from the region of Judea, would have felt very comfortable talking with their fellow Jews in Judea. It seems that, you know, God had called Paul specifically, you know, to go reach out to the Gentiles. You know, obviously Paul spoke to Jews on occasion as well. He would visit the synagogues to see if they would be interested in the gospel and support him. But ultimately his main task was to bring the gospel to the Gentiles. And the other apostles recognized this. They said, hey, Jesus appeared to all of us, made us all apostles. We preach the same gospel. But, you know, we're kind of focusing on different audiences. You know, we're kind of focused on the Jews, and you're focused on the Gentiles, and that's fine. You know, as long as we're preaching the same gospel message, that, in other words, both of our ministries are legitimate.
That's maybe just always surprised me from a human perspective a little bit, because if I were to pick someone who would be particularly equipped to minister to the Jews, I would pick Paul. I mean, Paul was the Jew of all Jews. He was a Pharisee, well trained, and he lists out his credentials. This almost would surprise us, I would think, that Paul would be one who isn't sent to the Jews.
Well, that's true. On the other hand, though, we know from a little bit about Paul that, you know, he was kind of raised in the city. He's kind of a city boy, whereas Peter is more of a, he's a fisherman in Galilee, you know, in the backwater town of Galilee, you know. Mm-hmm. And so Paul was much more comfortable with city life, because that's kind of where he was raised and where he was trained. His father was a Roman citizen, we know, mm-hmm. So he received Roman citizenship through his father. So, you know, there were some aspects, you know, Paul was highly educated. He was kind of a city guy. He was raised in the city. He was a Roman citizen. So, you know, I think from that standpoint, you know, that he would have been fairly comfortable in these cities, filled with people of very different backgrounds. You know, he definitely knew, he was well-educated. He knew the Gentile, the Greek poets and philosophers. You know, he had read them. So, you know, in a certain extent, I think, you know, God's choice is very understandable. You know, he would have, you know, there are certain parts of the Gentile culture that Paul was familiar with.
Yeah, good point.
He wasn't himself a Gentile, but he was familiar with some of these aspects of their culture.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Okay, well, verse 9 then continues, and when James and Cephas and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that was given to me, they gave the right hand of fellowship to Barnabas and me, that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. What's this right hand of fellowship that's being extended?
Yeah, it basically means that they are... Yeah, in other words, they're recognizing that they are in fellowship, that they are all part of the same community of believers. They are all part of the same church. They are essentially, recognizing each other as brothers. You know, we are united. We are the same mind and the same heart. And we were part of the same church. We share the same gospel. We can commune together. You know, we receive the Lord's Supper together. We have the same baptism. You know, they're recognizing essentially that there's this fundamental unity. And even though they have, you know, their one side group is kind of focused on the Jews, whereas the other side is more focused on the Gentiles, we're fundamentally united, and they are kind of embracing each other. They recognize this, and they embrace each other. And basically saying, you know, let's keep doing what we're doing. You know, we'll keep working on the Jews. You keep working on the Gentiles.
I think this language is used, retained in our congregations today, and I'm a little hazy on this. You might know better than I would, but I think when someone is received into membership by profession of faith, and it is to say that maybe they haven't undergone instruction or confirmation at a local congregation, but they've received instruction at another church that is in agreement, and they confess the same thing, that I think this language is borrowed, that the right hand of fellowship is extended. Is that, do you know that to be true, first of all, and is that a good use of this language from Galatians 2?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. We do that here at Holy Cross. We've been blessed that this past year or so we've had quite a few families actually transfer their membership over here. They moved to Albany from a ways away, and after talking with them and calling their pastor, I find out, oh yeah, you're baptized, you were a member in good standing, you've been catechized, you've been taught the faith, we're fundamentally in agreement, we share the same gospel. And so yeah, there's this rite that we do where in the church during the worship service where it's announced that they are going to be received into membership. And you're right. At some point, you say, we extend the right hand of fellowship with you, and you actually are supposed to kind of take their hand and, kind of shake their hand at that point. And yeah, we're borrowing it from this text. The handshake is, again, just, it's a physical depiction of, yeah, I'm recognizing you. I'm greeting you as a fellow brother. I see that we're fundamentally united. And, it's just it's a symbol of that unity and that embrace of brothers and sisters. I suppose there might be other symbols, other gestures we could do, instead of a handshake. It's actually interesting. There's another tradition in the early church where before you take the Lord's Supper, in order to show that you love your brothers and sisters and you forgive them their sins and you're one with them, you would go around and you would kiss each other on the cheek. You'd pass the kiss of peace. That was a very ancient old tradition, not done very much today in America, at least. But again, it's a gesture showing, hey, we're united. We share the same heart and mind, same baptism, the same Lord, same gospel. And that's basically what's going on here. And we have similar traditions today.
So some people might be hearing you talk about church membership and react by saying, well, that church membership talk, that's man's invention. That's a man-made institutional kind of a thing. How would you respond to that?
Oh, well, when I guess I would respond by just saying, well, I guess I fundamentally disagree with you. I mean, obviously, there are some man-made institutional stuff that we kind of have to have in order to just kind of function. I mean, human beings, we need that. Otherwise, how are decisions made? Once a decision is made, how is it carried out? I mean, for example, what do you do with the offering money? How do you use the money that the church has collected? Well, you need a way of deciding that, and you need a way of making sure it's carried out once the decision is made and so forth. So, yeah, some of the institutional stuff is man-made, but doesn't mean it's bad, But still, in terms of gathering together with other Christians and creating a faith community, that was happening already in the beginning. That was happening during the apostles. We're told in Acts that the first Christians kept gathering together. They would gather together to hear the apostles' teaching, to pray, to collect money for the poor, and to receive the Lord's Supper. And in Hebrews, the author of Hebrews says, do not neglect meeting together like some have. And we see this, that whenever Paul goes to a city, he converts a bunch of people. But those people don't just, well, I guess I'm a Christian, and they just kind of are Christian, individual Christians in their private, privately. No, these Christians in the city come together and form churches. And so Paul writes these letters to the churches in Galatia. He's writing to these assemblies, these gatherings of Christians who have formed faith communities. The Lord, there is no such thing as an individual lone wolf Christian. The Lord has always intended Christians to gather together, to support each other, to receive the word and sacraments together. If you are a Christian, you are part of a family of believers, and you cannot sever yourself from your fellow Christians. You can't do that. That is not optional.
Okay, so Paul says that James and Cephas and John extended the right hand of fellowship to Barnabas and himself. And then he says, they only asked us to remember the poor, the very thing I was eager to do. How does this go hand in hand with extending the right hand of fellowship?
Yeah, well, this is, again, you know, this is kind of Peter, James, and John. They're basically saying, you know, okay, you know, yeah, you're apostles and you're one of us, you share the gospel, but just make sure you're taking care of the poor. Remember the poor. And Paul says, well, of course we're going to take care of the poor, of course. When God shows great mercy to us, we then in turn show great mercy to each other. We love others the way God first loved us. I think, though, you know, this, remember the poor, it's quite possible that they have... Now, this isn't just a general thing, you know, oh, and by the way, remember the poor. Again, I'm speculating here, but if I'm right, and this is the second visit to Jerusalem, then there is a famine happening in Judea. That's why Paul and Barnabas come to Jerusalem, to bring a financial gift to the apostles in Jerusalem to help take care of the poor who are suffering during this famine. So I wonder, you know, are the apostles saying they received the first gift and they say, now keep, you know, don't forget us. You know, don't forget your brothers and sisters here in Judea. You know, go out to the Gentiles and proclaim the gospel to them. Absolutely. That's what you have been sent to do. But please don't forget us. You have brothers and sisters here who are hungry and in need. And Paul says, well, of course we're not, you know, we would never forget you. And of course we're going to be, you know, we're going to do everything we can to help take care of you. And I think there's something to be learned here. We do have responsibilities as Christians to take care of each other. You know, the church is God's family, so we are brothers and sisters. And so I always tell people, water is thicker than blood, referring to baptismal water, you know. And so, you know, we have obligations to our blood relatives, but we have an even higher obligation, I think, to the church. We need to love each other the way that God the Father loves us. And that means, you know, if your brother or sister is hurting, and you need to be there to help them and support them.
All right, we're going to be back with Pastor Alex Lang right after this, continuing our conversation and looking next at Galatians 2, verse 11. You're listening to Once for All. Stay tuned.
With SRN News, I'm Keith Peters in Washington. President Trump will call for a new American moment in Tuesday night's State of the Union address as he seeks to rally a deeply divided nation and infuse his presidency with a sense of optimism for at least one high-profile night. According to excerpts released ahead of the primetime address, the president will declare that there never has been a better time to start living the American dream. He's calling on lawmakers in both parties to join forces to modernize the nation's crumbling infrastructure and revamp immigration policies to focus on the best interests of American workers and American families. The White House said Tuesday it will conduct a legal and national security review before President Trump decides whether to release a classified memo on the Russia investigation that has sparked a political fight pitting Republicans against the FBI and the Department of Justice and Democrats. On Wall Street, the Dow down by 363 points. This is SRN News.
This is Sacred Meditations. Almighty and everlasting God, you govern all things both in heaven and on earth. Mercifully hear the supplications of your people, and in our time grant us your peace. Through Jesus Christ, our Lord, who lives and reigns with you and the Holy Spirit, one God, forever and ever. Amen. Prayers and meditations on God's Word, check out sacredmeditations.org. Thank you for making Sacred Meditations part of your day.
With SRN Sports, I'm Patrick Foss. You often hear the phrase blockbuster trade, but this really is. The LA Clippers have agreed to trade All-Star forward Blake Griffin to the Detroit Pistons. Clippers received Tobias Harris, Avery Bradley, Boban Marjanovic, and a first and second round draft pick. Griffin averaged 22.6 points and 7.9 rebounds for the Clippers, who are in ninth place in the Western Conference. Last night, Jaylen Brown hit a go-ahead three-pointer with 34 seconds remaining as Boston won at Denver 111-110, pushing the Eastern Conference leading Celtics to just their second win in seven games. The Milwaukee Bucks remained perfect under interim coach Joe Prunty after thumping Philadelphia 107-95. Bucks center John Henson.
Just playing well. We beat the teams we're supposed to beat, and Philly tonight, we're not going to kid ourselves. We didn't have him beat, but you got to play the guys in front of you, and that's what we did.
The Bucks are 4-0 under interim coach Joe Prunty. This is Esther in sports.
Welcome back to Once for All. It is great to have you with us today. We always like hearing from our listeners. Again, the toll-free number is 1-844-51-FAITH, or send me an email, deliveredonceforall@gmail.com. We're on the line with Pastor Alex Lang of Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Albany, Oregon, and we're talking about Galatians chapter 2. I want to take a look now at verse 11, which says, "But when Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned." Now, this "but" is in contrast to what we just had before the break, Pastor Lang, that in the preceding verses, he just got done saying that the right hand of fellowship was extended to him, but now he's opposing Cephas to his face. And maybe it'd be worthwhile reading the next verse to get a little context. It says, "For before certain men came from James, he was eating with the Gentiles, but when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party." Would you explain what's going on here?
Yeah, so just, well, first of all, let's just, for this, I probably should have done this before, but just to make sure that there's no confusion, when we talk about Cephas, we're talking about Simon Peter, right? Mm-hmm. So this is, it's not uncommon for people in the ancient world to have several names that they go by, and certainly that's true. True even of Paul, he goes by Saul and Paul, probably Saul being his Jewish name, and Paul is kind of his Roman name, the name he uses when he's relating to Gentiles. So it's not uncommon for them to have, multiple names in the ancient world. And so Cephas, whenever you hear that name, it's Simon Peter. It's the fisherman who becomes a disciple of Jesus, the same Simon Peter who writes two of the letters found in our New Testament. So I just wanted to make sure, we need to, realize that. We need to make sure that we understand who we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. So Cephas, he comes to Antioch. Antioch is one of the first places where there is a church made up of both Jews and Gentiles, and they have fellowship with each other, and they're living together as one church. And he comes and visits them, and they, are having meals together. And at first, Cephas is eating with these Gentile Christians in their meals. But then there's these men, Jewish Christians who come from James, come from Jerusalem. They come to Antioch, and they see Peter doing this, and they apparently don't like it, or they're concerned by it, and basically, we're going to find out that Peter decides to then separate himself from these Gentile Christians when they're eating. He's not going to eat with them anymore. He stops eating with them. And we're going to see that Paul doesn't like that, that Paul is going to oppose Peter and condemn him for hypocrisy. Now, I think it's, we need to ask ourselves, well, why did they not, what's the issue here? What's the problem? Why is it bad for, apparently bad for Peter to be eating with these Gentiles? The most common answer, of course, is that there's something wrong with the food. It's possible that they were eating unkosher food, unclean animals, or that they were eating something that wasn't tithed properly, or possibly even they're eating meats that could have been, that was bought from in the Gentile marketplaces and might have been meat sacrificed to idols. There's something wrong with the food. That's a very common approach to this. But the scholar Andrew Doss wrote the Concordia Commentary for Galatians, and he has a really great section on this, and he's not convinced by that. He says that it seems unlikely that the problem is what's being eaten. It would be very, you know, of course, a lot of these Gentiles knew that Jews didn't like certain, you know, wouldn't eat certain foods. It would have been very easy for them to just, you know, not have anything like that on the table, or having lots of options so that Peter can eat, you know, kosher food while they eat unkosher food. He just says that, you know, that it's hard to believe that would have been a problem. It would have been easy to solve such a problem, and it's a lot of these Gentiles probably were God-fearing Gentiles. In other words, they were going to the synagogue before they were converted to Christianity, and so they would have known, you know, you don't serve pork when you have Jews over for dinner. Much more likely is that it's not what they're eating, it's who you're eating with. In other words, the problem is that he's eating with Gentiles. And at this point in time, a lot of the Jews were saying that, you know, we shouldn't even relate to Gentiles. You know, so for example, one Jew named Diodorus Siculus, he was writing in the time of Jesus. He says that Jews do not engage in table fellowship with non-Jews. There's other examples of this in literature. A lot of Gentiles writing at the time of Jesus note that the Jews are unwilling to eat with us, that they refuse to dine with us. We actually see this in the Gospels, where Jesus is criticized for eating with tax collectors and sinners. You know, they were very, you know, you only eat with very good, pious Jews who are keeping the law. And I think what's going on here, Doss suggests that these Jews sent from James, they see Peter eating with the Gentiles, and they pull him aside and they say, look, Peter, you're supposed to be preaching the gospel to the Jews, but if the Jews see you eating with Gentiles, they're not going to want to have anything to do with you. In fact, they may try to persecute the church. They may try to hurt you. Your entire ministry will be ruined. So you need to stop eating with Gentiles so that you can focus on serving the Jews. And Peter, he says, okay. Now, at first you think, oh, well, that makes sense. You know, of course. You know, you shouldn't eat with the Gentiles so you can bring the gospel to the Jews. But there's a lot of problems with that. First, you know, first of all, you may confuse the Gentiles. You may give the Gentiles the impression that they have to become Jewish before they can have fellowship with you and be part of the church. You're not living according to the truth. The truth is that this all believers are part of one family, the church, and by not eating with them, you're in a sense you're treating them like they're not part of the family, like they're not equal with you, like there's something wrong with them. And Paul says, no, you have to live in accordance with the gospel. You have to live as if these Gentiles are right with God and your brothers and sisters. Maybe to help, a helpful analogy would be this: imagine we were living in, you know, before we, you know, the segregation in America was dissolved, you know, when racism was a huge problem. Imagine you are trying to be a pastor in the South. Do you stop eating with your African-American Christian brothers and sisters so that you can minister to the white Caucasian Christians? The answer is no, you can't do that. Why? Because you are part of the same family. These African Americans are your brothers and sisters. They are accepted by God. There's nothing wrong with them. They are truly Christian, and therefore you can't pull away from them. You're sending the wrong message if you do, and you know, in a sense, you're sinning against your brothers and sisters if you do that. And so that's what is going to make Paul mad. He's going to, you know, say, you need to cut this out, Peter. You need to treat the Gentiles like sons and daughters of God, because that's what they are.
And this seems to affect Barnabas, who was with Paul, and the right hand of fellowship was extended to him, because the next verse says that, lost my spot here, that the rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with him, so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy.
Yeah, right. And this is why, you know, Paul says that he opposes Peter to his face, and then it says that he opposes him publicly. He in other words, that when Paul begins to rebuke Peter, it's in public. Why? Because he sinned in public, and his sin has caused others to sin. In other words, the sin is kind of spreading. Everyone saw Peter refusing to eat with the Gentiles, and so Barnabas and these other Jewish Christians go, oh, well, maybe we need to stop eating with them too. We need to stop. And by the way, it's not like Peter here and Barnabas are saying, thinking, oh, the Gentiles must obey the law in order to be saved. It's not like they're giving up the gospel. It's they're not living in accordance with the gospel. They believe the gospel, but they're not. They're living in such a way that it seems to contradict the gospel.
Is this what we are, at least for myself, constantly reminding our people what confession are we making? What witness are we making by the actions of what we do?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. If you believe something, then you're going to behave a certain way. Your actions should flow from your heart. Your heart influences what you do. And so, what does your action say about your heart, about what you believe and think? Right. And that's exactly right. Paul's saying, Peter, you say one thing that you believe this, but then your actions say something completely different. And that's sinful. You need to make sure that your words and your actions match up. That you're giving a confession by a right confession of the gospel, both in what you say and in what you do.
Let's just hear what Paul actually says then, verse 14. But when I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas before them all, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? Great point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's kind of in a way... pointing out his hypocrisy, saying, hey, I've seen you. You were living, you were a Jew, but you were living like a Gentile. And now you are by your actions, you're encouraging these Gentiles to become Jewish. What gives? Were you sinning? Were you sinning when you were living like a Gentile, or are you sinning now by? Asking these Gentiles to become Jewish, it's either one or the other. it's a great question, a great rhetorical question by Paul that immediately exposes that there's something wrong with Peter's actions, that he's not living consistently.
And lastly, before we let you go, Pastor Lang, in conclusion, what's the main takeaway from the first 14 verses of chapter 2? What do we need to know about these verses as we prepare for next week?
Well, we went through a lot of stuff, so there's a lot you can take away from this. But I would say, as we prepare for next time, think about this. The gospel is not just about you and God. It is about you and God, but there's horizontal implications to the gospel. And so, God, Jesus died for the sins of the whole world, and God calls and gathers all believers together into one church. And so if the gospel is true, that should affect how you treat your neighbor. And I would take that, that would be something I would take away from the story about Peter. He believed the gospel, but he didn't realize that the gospel has some implications about how he should treat others.
We've been talking with Pastor Alex Lang. He's pastor of Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Albany, Oregon. Pastor Lang, we appreciate all the work you put into and spending the time and teaching us the book of Galatians. Thank you for coming on.
Hey, thanks.
And thanks for listening to this edition of Once for All. If you miss any part of today's broadcast, you can listen to it again at your leisure by going over to our website, onceforallradio.com. You can also call us with any comments or questions. Leave a message at this number, 1-844-51-FAITH, 1-844-51-FAITH. And we'd love to get your emails as well, deliveredonceforall@gmail.com. That's it for us on today's edition of Once for All. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
This has been Once for All. You can contact the show by sending an email, deliveredonceforall@gmail.com. You can listen again to this show or any other episodes by visiting onceforallradio.com. Until next time, stand firm in the faith, once delivered to the saints.